My pain is really hard. It's shitty, and I wouldn't wish it on a soul. And I miss my dad every day, and I wouldn't wish a divorce on anyone. It's so hard. But those things, those broken things, like, they have only made me a better, like, more whole version of myself. And I believe that for everyone.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 3 of Tinker Podcast. Well, what an amazing week it has been. Last weekend we launched our first 2 episodes and we were just blown away at the response. Thank you everyone who listened and particularly those of you who gave feedback. As I mentioned in earlier episodes, this podcast is a bit of an experiment, so we're really new to this, so your comments are really appreciated. And listen, if you are a fan of what you're hearing so far, well, we would be grateful if you hop on over to iTunes and leave a review. Or if you just want to connect, you can always email me direct at tyson.wheatley@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Okay, let's talk about this week's guest, Ruthie Lindsay. Ruthie is a Nashville-based interior designer. She's a stylist and a creative director. And if you've met her, you already know that she has this way of making you feel special and welcome in a really remarkable way. To say Ruthie is friendly would be an understatement. She is a beam of light. She's a wave of positivity and love, which makes her story of pain and suffering almost impossible to comprehend. Few people, if any, will know what it's like to live with Ruthie's chronic pain. But you would never guess what she's been through if she didn't tell you her story. Now, I was able to hear it myself last weekend when I caught up with Ruthie at Urban Cowboy Bed and Breakfast in Nashville, and I feel extremely fortunate to be able to share it with you now. I don't know if I'm ready for this.
Yes, you are.
I just woke up and I have only had one cup of coffee.
It's fine.
You don't drink coffee.
I don't drink coffee. I just don't like how it tastes, and I wake up kind of just like this.
Pre-caffeinated.
Yes. So what's the point, you know? I don't really need it. It's fine.
You are a ball of energy. Ruthie, how do you make that paper?
Like, what's my job?
Yeah.
How do you make that dollar bill, girl?
That is something that I'm curious about.
I know. Yeah. It's so funny. My mom will even ask, like, what do I tell people what you do? I'm like, great question. I don't know. Now I've kind of mirrored it in, and I'll say, well, I am lucky enough to be a stylist for, like, photos and events. And then lately, in the last year, like, half of my time I do public speaking, which has been such a gift. And so I had no idea that I loved it. And like, I spoke at my first conference. I've never been to a conference in my lifetime. I know nothing about that world. Mm-hmm. Last September. And I loved it. I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. So I do public speaking. And then I do a lot of marketing for like brands, and that usually comes out through like social media. So brands will hire me either to show how I'd like wear or style their product, or like the lifestyle of a place. Like Soho House just sent me down to Nicaragua to show what it's like for their members to go on these retreats called Weekenders Retreats, and I would just post about what it's like to go on that, you know. So
how do those people find you?
I guess on the interwebs. I have no idea. I've never had a resume in my life, ever. We're going after a job in my life. I feel like the biggest fraud and the biggest joke, because I feel like I've just tricked a lot of folks, but I don't know.
You know, what would you like to be doing like a year from now?
Yeah, I mean, I am so wherever I am. I've never been great at, like, I've hurt friends' feelings, because like when I was in high school, I loved high school the most and I was like the happiest human. And then I left and I was like, college is the best thing that ever happened to me. And I was like in love with it. And I thought everyone there was the best humans I ever, you know. And then it's not that I forgot my high school friends, but I was just so where I was. And then I came to Nashville. I'm like, this is the best place I've ever been in my life. And I'm like obsessed with this place. So I'm just so here that it's kind of hard for me to see future stuff. Like I know that my greatest, the thing that I feel is the most life-giving is I get to share my story, which and connect with other people that are suffering and share this like message that you can live an incredibly rich and beautiful life despite your circumstances and even in the midst of suffering. I mean, we haven't talked about it yet, but like I
we haven't. I mean, I figured we could get into it. You know, I've been thinking about this morning about how what the best way to get into it. So that maybe we should just get into it. I mean, I'm really familiar with your story because, you know, we've met and you've shared it with me, and I think it's really powerful, and I want you to share it, of course, on the podcast. But before we got too deep into that, I kind of wanted to learn more about some things about you that I don't know.
Yeah, like, of course.
For instance, like your childhood.
Yeah. You know? Childhood. Oh, I love to talk about my
childhood.
What's
Ruthie like as a child?
A whole... Oh, yeah. Y'all don't see me. I'm sitting here in overalls, and I was a lot like me now.
So you were wearing overalls as a kid?
I wore overalls, and I was just... Yeah, I was a...
Set me the scene. Like, where does this all happen?
So I grew up in South Louisiana on a farm in the middle of nowhere. I had zero neighbors, which killed me. I grew up with older brothers, and they're amazing. My family was pretty great. Like, my life was so beautiful. I just assumed everyone was, like, happy. And I was pretty clueless about, you know, the ways of life and the hard things. Because we didn't have a lot of money, but, like, we had a very rich life. Like, I played outside. Like, literally, we walked outside in the morning time in the summer and didn't come back in until it was dark, you know. And, like, we just played. And my brothers, I slept in my oldest brother's room until he graduated high school. Like, I was his shadow. He was 7 years older than me and, like, just loved me so well. And the only thing that was hard for me, I was so social, as you know, and so extroverted and had no neighbors. And so I literally signed myself up for summer camp when I was, like, coming out of second grade for a month. And my mom was like, that's too long. I'm like, nope, I'll be fine. I will love it. And of course, never got homesick, loved it, went every summer, and was like happiest human. So it was like a slumber party every night with this a bunch of girls, and I was in heaven. But yeah, I was in this teeny tiny town, two red lights. I mean, up until eighth grade, I had 23 people in my grade.
Wow.
Yeah, most people don't leave. It's a very small town, but it's amazing, and the community is really incredible. Like, I knew what it was like to live in a very intentional community. Like, my parents' friends are amazing and we're always around. And yeah, I mean, it was a very picturesque, like Southern, very Southern home life. I don't know. It was great. Like,
you guys went to church every Sunday?
Not every Sunday. It was like more of just a, you go. It wasn't like as much of coming home. Like, my parents were very intentional about, like, every time we left home as a child, my dad would say, I love you so much, remember your manners, and always look out for the little guy. But it wasn't like, because Jesus says so. You know, it wasn't like, it didn't indoctrinate our daily lives. It was more like, just go love people and serve people and care about people. And
what your parents do?
So my dad, until I was in eighth grade, was my principal. And then he also taught history. And so I rode to school with him every day.
Teacher's pet.
No. Oh, gosh. He went above and beyond to make sure, like, if we got in trouble, we get in way more trouble than any of the other kids. And so my oldest brother led the way in what not to do and got in so much trouble and then would get punished way more than anyone else. And so my other brother and I were just like angels and never got in trouble. The only reason I ever got upset, my teacher's upset, is because I talked too much. And he would like move me to every desk trying to get me to not talk with a student. And of course I would like love them too and become friends with them.
Now, did you have a paddle at your school?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, you did not.
Some kids would get a paddling.
Oh yeah, they get whooped. Wow. It's like a different world.
Yeah.
I went to
school in Florida when I was in first and second grade, and the principal had a paddle hanging above his. He never used it on me, but he showed it to me.
Oh yeah, he let you
a couple
know.
Times.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh yeah, paddling was a real thing, and you just don't even think twice about it because that's all you know. You know.
I was scared to death of that paddle.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
Oh my gosh, I had the fear of God in like in sense of the office.
It seems like such a strange thing now.
I know.
You know, like you would never hit a child, never ever.
I know. Think twice
and
about it.
It was normal.
I know it was totally normal to us, olden days. So my mom was my preschool teacher.
Oh, wow.
And then my dad was my principal. And then in ninth grade, he became superintendent of our parish. So he was over all the schools in our parish, mm-hmm. and I still rode to school with him every day until I got my license. And yeah, it was a sweet time. I mean, I never knew anything different, and I loved it. And everyone, my dad was just an amazing educator, and everyone loved him. They had like kind of a fearful respect for him, but also loved him. He was like a father figure. We always had kids living with us at all times. Like, it was never just me and my brothers. It was always filled with other kids that had hard family lives for one reason or another. And so, yeah, he was an amazing human. So,
I see where a lot of these qualities come from. Did you have a favorite subject in school?
Oh my gosh. I was the worst student ever. Like, I literally, why? I was a nightmare. School was really hard for me, and it was such a like small, it wasn't, I didn't know I was creative. I didn't take an art class. I never knew what I was good at. Like, everyone would be like, you know, I'm great with English or I'm great with history, but I'm the worst with math. And I'm like, I am total shit at all of it. Like, the only thing, I'm not even kidding, that I was great at was recess. I was like master recessor. Like, I was friends with everyone and loved it. And like, we had the best time, but like, school was really hard. I mean, I literally,
are you like athletic? Is that what you mean? You were good at recess?
No, just the social part of it.
Oh,
playing. Hanging well, you're, with my friends.
How tall are you? If you don't mind me asking.
So I am right above 6 feet, and I've been this height since I was 13. But I didn't know that I should be embarrassed about that.
So you must have been, you shouldn't be embarrassed. I was thinking you would dominate in like Foursquare or something like that.
I was actually very athletic, but I'm like the least competitive human in life. Like, they tried to make me play basketball because I'm a giant. And every time I would block a shot, I would apologize to the other team member. And they'd make me run stadiums. And I'm like, y'all, I just want to dance. Like, leave me alone. I just want to dance. Stop. So I hated it. Like, I literally do not have a competitive bone in my body, and I just enjoy like playing and dancing and I don't know. I did not get into, but I was like, I actually did have skills. Like, my brothers and my dad, they were super athletic and very coordinated, and so I had it in me. I just didn't care about it at all. So that, like, I'm sure was heartbreaking to the
coaches.
Didn't
care about athletics.
No.
Didn't care about learning.
No.
Sounds like.
Coming home since from like second grade, I'm not kidding, and I still couldn't read. And I was like telling my mom, I was so heartbroken because everyone went up and down the class and they're like having to read little sections of a book. And I was like, Mom, I couldn't do it. And I was like so traumatized that I couldn't read and everyone else was doing great. And then I piggybacked it. And I was like, I had this friend in elementary school, and I was like, I can always tell when she's telling a lie. Like, she came to school today and she was telling a lie to everyone. And I was like, I was a very intuitive, very, I was like emotional, but not in an overly emotional, but just a very in tune, self-aware and socially aware child. I was very like in tune with like, there was hard things going on. I was very aware. There was like great, like if the teacher was this, I'd be like, something's going on with the teacher. Like, I knew, I was just very, and so I like piggybacked it with saying something like very emotionally mature for a 7-year-old. And my mom was like, babe, you will be just fine. Like, she didn't go like, she's like, you can never read and you'll be just fine. Like, you will literally, you'll thrive because you have social intelligence. She like basically put it in layman's terms for a second grader, but just basically saying like, there are different types of smart, and you're smart. Yeah. I just, you know, is emotional intelligence. And that's, I mean, for me, school, I definitely had some learning disabilities, but my dad also didn't want me to be labeled with that. And so I would come home, he was the exact same way. And so I would like tell him what we were learning in school, and he would teach me in the way he, I'm so visual, and I'm a, like, I need to see things as I hear them. And I need, and so he would tell me stories instead of like looking at a book and reading it. Or he would like, he's a storyteller. And so he would make it where I would understand it. So I'd come home and be like, okay, today in history class, we learned about blah, 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 blah. And I have no idea what they were talking about. And then he would explain it to me in a way that made sense to me. And then I would ace the test because my dad taught me in a way that was like conducive to my brain learning, because he learned the exact same way. So I was very fortunate to have him at home, you know. But yeah, school, I was never into it. I learned how to study, but it never came naturally to me at all. Like, I didn't get it. And I mean, it's interesting now thinking about, like, if I had taken art class, like, I didn't know I was creative. I didn't know that I was always very obsessed with the arts, like, mm-hmm. obsessed with music, obsessed with, like, anything beautiful. I was incredibly obsessed with beauty, like, whatever that would look like. I loved flowers. I would, like, literally redecorate my room and change it around and drag furniture just from place to place. And I would do that in my playhouse over and over and over just because I loved creating spaces that were beautiful. And like, but like in my head, you know, I didn't take photos. I didn't paint. I didn't make music. And so I didn't think I was creative. I didn't know. I was obsessed with beauty. I just had no clue that I could create it. And so it'd be interesting now, you know, if I had taken classes that actually were conducive to my brain and creative, like what mm-hmm. that might have looked like. I mean, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. So it all worked out completely fine. But school was a real struggle, like a real struggle for me. So I don't know. But my childhood was amazing. And I was just super, super fortunate. Like, yeah, I mean, I kind of went through life a little blissfully ignorant. I just thought that's what mm-hmm. most people's childhood was like. And they got to go home to two parents and, you know, have brothers that loved them really well and doted on them. Like, they spoiled me in the best way, but also kept me very grounded. Like, I remember coming home in like sixth grade and I was being a bitchy girl. And I was talking about girls in my class and my oldest brother looked at me and he was like, babe, I am never going to let you be. Nobody wants to be around a bitchy girl, and I will not let you act that way. Like, don't talk about them that way. That's not okay. And I literally felt like the voice of God had come down to me and like, I was so embarrassed of myself. Like, my brother I never got in trouble. I was like a really good kid, and he never had to get on to me. So I was just like, and of course, like, wept. I was like almost in the fetal position. I was so brokenhearted. But from that moment, I was like, I don't ever want to be that. Like, if he says that's bad, then that's the worst, you know? And like, they doted on me and like told me how loved I was, but they also would never allow me to act spoiled or bratty or snotty or, you know. Yeah,
that sound like good big brothers.
Very good. Amazing big brothers.
How old were you when you got married?
Oh gosh, we were babies. I was like, he was my first boyfriend and we were married within 10 months. he was 21 and I was 23, I think. Have just made that up. It was somewhere around there. We were real young.
You were older than he was. Where'd you meet him?
I met him here in Nashville. I was living with this precious girl. I moved to Nashville, got a job doing youth work, and was living with her. And her boyfriend is this great musician named Griffin House. And Will was coming over to talk to him about doing his first like full band record. Mm-hmm. And I opened the door and met him, and it was pretty instant.
So you fell in love with a musician.
I did.
Yeah.
With an amazing musician. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, like, he also had a very good heart and a sweet, you know, spirit. But he's also very, very, very talented.
Wow. 10 months. That's a pretty amazing
I know.
Time.
What
yeah.
the hell?
Yeah.
We were clueless. Absolutely so clueless. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, my parents were like nervous that I liked girls up to that point because I'd never dated anyone. I was never interested in dating anyone. I had, you know, I grew up in this house of boys and I just...
Nervous that you liked girls.
But yeah.
They thought you were a lesbian.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we met and it was pretty instant and we were married within 10 months and we kind of started our lives together and we were just excited and we bought a house over here in East Nashville, like less than a mile from where we are right now and... I guess we lived there 8 years and then sold it and moved into another house, which now the folks that own the Peach Truck have, and they're so precious. I love that they're there. And we bought that one. And then, yeah, I found myself like single after buying that house, like probably like 6 weeks later. So it was a pretty whirlwind, wild thing. Yeah.
When is the accident?
So accident, here's what's crazy. Accident actually happened when I was a senior in high school. I pulled out in front of an ambulance and he hit me on my door going like 65 and I broke my ribs. They punctured my lungs collapsed, my spleen ruptured. And then I broke C1 and C2, which are the top two vertebrae in your neck. And I had like a 5% chance to live and a 1% chance to walk, but the driver saved my life. And I was just really lucky, like, I mean, I shouldn't be here. Like, we know that. But he had everything here to save me. I was on life support and the whole thing. And it was on my dad's birthday, which is crazy.
Okay, sorry to pause you.
No, you're good.
Do you still have a relationship with the ambulance driver at all?
I don't. I could probably find him. We kept in touch a little bit, and then I think he kind of had some hard stuff and ended up losing his job, and so he kind of fell off a little bit. I think there was just some addiction problems, but that wasn't a part of what, I mean, it was my fault. Like, I pulled out in front of him.
You pulled out.
Yeah, it was all, he was on his way home.
Oh.
Yeah, it was totally my fault.
Yeah.
And then
he was able to save you.
Yeah, he saved my life.
Just because he had all the equipment right there.
And like, you know, I was breathing, and like, he knew how to stabilize my neck. If someone had tried to pull me out, I mean, I broke the top two vertebrae and I'm walking right now, which is a miracle. Like, anybody, so when you break above C5, people usually die or they're brain dead or paralyzed. And I was crazy fortunate. Like,
what do you remember of that day?
I don't remember much. I remember I had organized, go figure, a group of us to go to this place called Celebration Station. It was a bunch of seniors, and we had we were all driving together and have the worst sense of direction.
Celebration Station.
Yeah, it's like a basically a really janky, like, they have like rides and go karts and, you know, like games and pizza.
Okay.
And
gotcha.
So I just organized all these things.
Mini golf.
Probably.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I didn't make it there, but so there was just like a bunch of seniors, and I have the worst sense of direction. You can talk to any friend of mine, like Garrett's like, if you think to go left, always go right, because you're always freaking wrong. Like, I have the worst sense of direction. And so we'd stopped at this gas station. I was like the only one of our friends that didn't drink. Everyone drank, and at that point it was legal at 18. And so we'd stopped at this gas station for them to get liquor, and I didn't know how to get there, and I was the last car. So I think the last thing I remember is asking one of my friends. He is just this like amazing tall black man. He's like the best football player in the world ever, and just like the star of our football team. And he had the best like selection of rap music ever. So I remember going up to his window and asking if I could borrow a rap CD for the rest of the ride, and him giggling and like handing me some CDs. And that's the last thing I remember. And then,
you were alone. You were driving alone.
No, my best friend from high school was in the car with me. He helped the guy save my life. Like, my car door ended up in the passenger seat, and Brian was able, like untouched, was able to get out and help the guy save my life.
Amazing.
I know. Okay. And that's, I think about that. Like, if I had hurt someone, like, you know, I don't know how I would have emotionally handled that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was so lucky, and like back then I was on life support for a while, and after I was stable, they took bone from my hip, my right hip, and they fused it into my neck. And back then they used wire and spinal cord fusions and wrapped it with wire, and that's just what that was the protocol. That's what everyone did back in the day. And then years later, so I mean, I was so lucky. I was in the hospital for a month, but then I went back to life as normal. Like, I wore a neck brace for 5 or 6 months, and you know, like, I cheered at our last basketball game.
You're the local celebrity, right?
Oh, God, I don't know about all that. But
well, you know, cheated death, basically.
Yeah. And our town's tiny. Everyone knows each other. Like,
everyone must have known about the accident. Yeah.
Absolutely. My hospital room, like, we just started passing it out to floors of people, flowers and food, because, like, it literally looked like a party. Like, it was just the sweetest. Like, it was literally flowers lining the hallway, and just our town, our community was incredible.
So a month later, you're walking.
Yeah.
With a neck brace.
Yeah.
And you have wires in your in your neck and back.
Right? Yeah. In my spinal cord.
And so in terms of your sort of outlook, future outlook, you think,
I dodged
a bullet.
Yeah, I feel like, and at the time, especially then, I didn't have repercussions from it. Like, I went back to life as normal. I didn't have, if I danced too much, I'd get a little sore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had scars, obviously, but all my scars are also hidden by clothing. Like, I have a huge one on my neck, and I have one that's like runs the length of my torso, and like have ones on my hips and where the chest tubes were, but like, nothing else. If you, by looking at me, you'd never know. And I looked the same, I acted the same. And so it's like, I kind of went back like nothing had happened. And I'm such a like in the present, I don't think about the past. I'm just like, life's great, you know? So I went to college, had the worst student ever, and had a blast, like loved life more than you can imagine. And then I was offered a job in Nashville right out of school. And so I came, and I didn't know a soul, and I met amazing people and loved it. And I mean, met Will not long after, and probably a year into our marriage, we were just so excited. I was touring with him a ton, and I was walking one day in Nashville outside of like the Starbucks and Smoothie King area, And I had this like shooting pain go up my neck that was like debilitating, and it dropped me to my knees, and I felt like I was gonna like black out, and I vomited, and it was just like this crazy shooting pain that left this crazy migraine, and it scared me to death. And this started happening a lot, and we started this really long process of trying to figure out what was causing it. And what was wild is every time we go to these like neurologists and orthopedic surgeons, they'd have me do a CAT scan, and the magnet in the machine would interact with the wire in my spinal cord fusion, and they'd say, oh, that's just the magnet, you know, there'd be this black spot on my film, so you wouldn't see the break, you just see everything around it. And they're like, that's normal, that's just the magnet interacting with the wire, but everything around it looks fine. So I tried all these therapies, nothing helped. And that's when they started prescribing pretty intense pain medication, because I was like, I mean, it was debilitating. Like, I was in my bed, like non-functional, like couldn't, it was awful. And
yeah,
it was so scary.
And describe debilitating.
Like, literally didn't get out of my bed. Like, I, because it literally, it was shooting, and it was happening more and more often.
So the only time you could find relief was just to lay down.
And it's not basically even that I found relief in that, but I just, like, everything made it seem worse. Like, if I turned my neck a little too much, or if I did anything, and I was just, it was.
I can't imagine. I cannot imagine.
The scariest, and it, I was so young, and I was like, okay, this is my life. And I tried all, go to all these specialists, and I would try, I mean, I would have like, I did this one therapy where they inject you with hundreds of needles and shoot you with this like sugar water, hoping that it would trigger, because there's trauma in those areas, then your body would think it could heal itself. It's like called prolotherapy, and it was the most painful thing. I mean, and I did it a bunch. Like, I was like desperate to try anything. Like, I would.
Desperation.
And I took everything they recommended because I just didn't want to hurt all the time. And I handled chronic pain really poorly. I didn't know how to handle it because I was just desperate to not hurt. And so I literally started this like life of living in my bed. And I can't even imagine how awful that was for my spouse. Like, sweet boy, like, I can't even.
You would spend days on end in your bed?
Days on end. I mean, this was like majority of my time was in my bed.
You're getting up for what?
Go to the bathroom, grab something frozen from the fridge.
Yeah.
Like, I would leave for little bits of the time, but also in that time.
How would you spend your time?
I literally watched the grossest amount of television that you could imagine, and I read the most obscene amount of books that you could comprehend. Like, I just wanted to escape my reality, and it was the most depressing, and I'm so social, but I was also didn't want to be a burden to people. So I was like, if they're around me, all they'll see is like my pain. And I also, at that time, I really led with my pain and said, that's how everyone saw me. You know, I just was like, I was my pain. It consumed me. It consumed me. And laying in my bed all the time, I was only more hyper-focused on how awful I felt, you know, and I handled it very poorly. And that went on for almost 7 years. But after 4 years or 5 years of that, finally a doctor in Texas was like, I can't tell you what's going on until I see what's under that black spot. And so a $50 x-ray basically showed that one of the wires had broken and pierced my brainstem. And I'm the only person in the world that's ever had that. And he was like, I've never heard, I mean, he was like the most monotone, boring sounding doctor in life. And the voicemail he left me sounded like manic, like literally, you've got to get back here right now.
Tell me the voicemail. What did it say?
He basically, I couldn't even call him back. I was too scared. But he left a voicemail saying, you know, I don't remember all of it because I kind of like blacked out when I got it. I was so, and I definitely have some PTSD around hospitals, doctors, you know, but basically, the wires pierced into my brainstem. I need to get back there as soon as possible. I should be paralyzed, but it was like a ticking time bomb. Like, I will be eventually if
you
don't get it out.
So he's telling you to do what? Come to Texas?
Yeah, but I was too scared to go there. And so I like basically passed it off to my brothers who are both in the medical field. One's a general practitioner doctor, and the other one literally sells medical equipment to spinal cord surgeons. And so we had it all sent to them, and they took over for me and showed it to a bunch of surgeons, and everyone, it was hard. Everyone had the same opinion, no one had heard of it, that I should be paralyzed, I would be if I didn't get it, and the surgery itself was super high risk of paralysis, but I had to do it. Like, there's no, I will
no
be
choice.
Paralyzed.
You have to have this.
I have to have the surgery. So I was scared out of my mind, And 2 weeks later, my dad, I called him Papa, was coming to visit me and wanted to tell me that he would sell our farm so I could have the surgery because insurance, I had a pre-existing injury and insurance wouldn't cover it. And the night before he was coming to see me, he fell down a flight of stairs, freak accident, and ended up passing a brain damage. And it was just the most hellacious few weeks. I remember waking up and I would just like, I would draw blood, like pinching myself, because I was like, I have to be in a nightmare. Like, this can't be real. This can't be real life. Like, I have to be in a nightmare right now. It was awful, 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 but also sweet things came from that. Like, my godfather set up a medical fund in my dad's honor because he knew that's what he wanted, was for me to have the surgery. And people came from out of the woodworks. Like, people would write letters to my brothers and I and be like, your dad sent me to college. Your dad pays my rent. Your dad fixed my roof. Your dad bought my prom dress. Your dad sent me on my senior trip. We were not wealthy at all. But my dad, like, that thing where you'd say, always look out for the little guy, like, he wanted us to love people and see people, and that's what he did. He took care of humans that needed help and loved them well. And so this crazy amount of money was raised because my dad had loved people so well. And we were just, like, blown away. And I was, like, so honored that, like, that was my father, you know? But I also was, like, I just wanted him there. So I ended up choosing the Mayo Clinic. Doctors were chomping at the bit to work on me. Like, people were coming out of the woodwork wanting to do the surgery because they get off on, like, being the only ones to do something that's never been done.
Oh, that's weird.
And that was super weird. And it's not like I could go off experience. No one had done it. But I chose Mayo, and this, like, top neurologist, top orthopedic surgeon did my surgery together. And it was, you know, one of those things where you're like, I thought I knew pain, and I had no idea.
You could feel the pain?
When I woke up, it was like the most intensive pain I've ever known in my life.
Okay.
Like, I had, like, busted, you know, blood vessels.
Can you describe the sort of, you wake up from this?
And I was just screaming. They could hear me screaming. Wow. Like, it was the most, and so okay. They had took bone out of my other hip and they removed the wire and then they refused it with like 8 titanium screws into my brainstem and spinal cord. So I had like a ton of spinal cord leakage in my, where the hole was, where they removed the wire, and which also gives you like the craziest headaches you've ever known. And just, it was, I mean, it's, I'm grateful now. I've blocked out a lot of it because it was so intensive. Like, I literally, all I remember from waking up in ICU is just screaming. Like, I literally, like, blood vessels popping in eyes, like blood curling screams. I've never known pain like that. But I was also, it was so scary. Like, I didn't know if I was going to wake up and be able to move and be paralyzed, you know?
But you're in a lot of pain, but you're not paralyzed.
I can move my fingers. Okay. And that's a miracle.
But so what's the prognosis? Do they come in and tell you at that point, like, so, it's going to be okay? Or?
So we knew right away that I was walking and that I was going to be able to walk and that I was moving. And so I, of course, was so grateful, but I couldn't even think about being grateful. Like, I was in so much, I was relieved, but also in just massively intensive. And it was interesting. So the shooting pain in my neck actually stopped, which was amazing. But I ended up, my pain changed pretty drastically after that. I ended up getting really intensive nerve damage down the right side of my body. And so, you know, leaving there, I was so grateful. Goodness, like, and eternally grateful to these doctors that I'm walking out of the hospital holding the wire that they removed from my brainstem. You know, I'm like, what the hell? That is insane.
How big of a piece?
I'll show you a photo. I mean, it's like, it would be hard for you to believe that was in my, like, it's like that big.
It's that round?
It's that, because it was thick. Wrapped around.
Oh, I see.
It's that round, but I mean, it's that thick. Like, yeah. It's okay. Hard. I don't know how to describe it. I don't know sizes, but like the roundness of like a quarter and the thickness of like, I don't know, what would you call that? Like a pencil lead?
Yeah.
A sure. Little bit thicker than a pencil lead. And I carried it out, you know, which was insane. And, you know, I get back home and to be honest, like, I went back to my old way of life, living in my bed. I was on even more pain medication, and I was hurting still really poorly, like really, really badly. The best way I know how to describe my pain now is like one time my right foot was standing in red ants and I didn't realize it. My brother like had to yell at me, and I looked down. I had like tons and tons and tons and tons of red ant bites up my right leg.
Oh my God.
Because that's just what it feels like. It just feels like fire. I hurt myself a lot on my right side. Like even on the way here, I was like, what's that? Like I have bruises and cuts and I'll burn myself, but I don't realize it because it doesn't ever register as much as what it always feels like. And so
to even day
today
mm-hmm. you live with chronic pain.
I do. Mm-hmm. And I lived that way in my bed for probably two more years after that surgery. And then a few summers ago, I guess it was four summers ago now, oh my gosh, I hit the biggest wall. I had caught C. diff in the hospital, which is this bacterial infection, which I will spare you the details because it's the grossest thing in life. Like the doctor wears a bodysuit when you come in because it's so horrific and so hard to get rid of and so awful. I thought I was going to die and I genuinely wanted to. I caught that in the hospital for like endometriosis surgery. And then my pain was still horrific. And I could tell my marriage was coming to an end. And I hit the biggest wall in life. Like I literally had a, like not like in a funny way, nervous breakdown. It was like a true full on, I was a nutbag nervous breakdown. Like I stopped sleeping for 20 something days and I was so panicked. And I felt so ashamed of myself. I thought about like, the way my dad lived and how he loved people and the way he changed people's lives. And I was laying in my bed, like taking from humans, not giving anything. Mm-hmm. Like I literally was just taking and I had nothing.
You feel some sense of guilt?
I felt shame. I don't know. Shame. I felt shame. I felt utter shame. I was so embarrassed of myself. I'd always been such a good kid. I'd never gotten in trouble. And here I was like literally having a nervous breakdown. My husband was on tour. I couldn't take care of him. I kept ending up in the emergency hospital, in the emergency room and in the hospital because I was so sick from C. diff. And my friends had to like take me because I was, you know, I couldn't take care of myself. And so finally I told my family how bad it was and they came and got me and moved me home. I was a nightmare and mortified and so ashamed. And I moved in with my oldest brother, whose room I slept in forever. And they just loved me so well. And it was like one of those things where it was the worst thing that ever happened. I've never felt such mental, emotional, physical pain. But that breakdown and that hitting that huge of a wall made me change everything. It was literally one of those things where I like, you know, you hear addicts talk about rock bottom. Like that was my below rock bottom. It was like, whatever I'm doing is obviously not working. I am a nightmare and I am only damaging those around me. Like I knew like my poor husband, like I can't even imagine what that was like for him, you know? And I don't blame him for not wanting to be there. Like I wouldn't want to be around me. I was the worst. And I was never
mean. You think that's, is that what happened? It just became too much for him to.
There was plenty. We had a lot of hard stuff and I handled it really poorly, you know? And I honestly don't, like, I genuinely don't blame him one bit. Like, I get it. I wouldn't. I hope he's so
There's
happy.
No hard feelings.
No hard feelings at all. I want the out. He stood with me for a long time and loved me well. As well as we possibly, we were so young and we didn't know how to handle hard. We had real hard things. Like that, this is like.
Well, Ruthie, I think very few people would know how to handle this kind of situation.
Yeah. And I know that.
It's pretty unique.
Yeah. And I have a lot of grace for that person.
Yeah.
You know, I don't hold bitterness to who I was and how it all played out. Because who knows how to handle chronic pain? We're not born knowing we're not meant to have pain like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I hit this wall and I just like, I have to change everything.
I feel like the comeback story is getting ready to happen.
Yeah, the redemption story! So literally, it was like, it was this incredible thing. Like, I was like, I remember having this conversation with my precious brother, and he was like, babe, you can lay in bed and hurt all the time, or you can get up and go love people and, like, serve people and live life and hurt. Like, where's your better option? I'm like, that sounds so simple. But I was like, and so I also in that time decided to wean myself off of 7 years of really, really, really heavy pain medication.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it real quickly, but I was just like, I was still hurting every second of every day, and it was only effing with my mind so much. It took me 4 months, and I remember probably 2 months in having this vision of myself like walking out getting glasses for the first time when I was 7 and being like, Mom, look at the sky, like in awe. And that's how I started feeling off
story.
Of these drugs. Yeah. Like I was able to see beauty again. Like on the drugs, all I felt was the depravity of the world, my pain, everyone else's pain around me. But I couldn't see the beautiful things to balance it, you know? And so I was like choosing. I was literally, it was like for the longest time, like I said earlier, I'd led with my pain. And so that's how everyone saw me. So when people would see me in public, they'd be like, how are you doing? How are you feeling? How's your back? You know? And in some gross way, I found comfort in that because it justified me being the worst and laying in my bed and being a horrible friend and being a horrible wife and not working and not being a productive human. Like it almost in my gross, not conscious mind, it justified stuff to me that people like felt sorry for me. And that point I was like, I don't want to, my pain is like a piece of me. This does not have to define me. And I want, when people leave my presence, I want them to feel like loved and cared for and special. I just stopped leading with my pain, and I started like looking to people and trying to look, I mean, like consciously to relearn how to live. I had to like go to therapy to learn, like at 8 a.m. your alarm goes off, you have to put your feet on the ground and you need to make your bed, and you're not allowed to get back in your bed until it's dark outside, and you have to get up and you need to take a shower and you need to put on deodorant. I mean, the simple, I had to learn how to live again because I had lived, not lived for so long. So like I went to occupational therapy to relearn how to function. And I was so consciously going, okay, you got to do the opposite of what you're doing. And I want to focus on the beautiful things around me, like in people and in places and experiences, and like not only see it, but like speak it out loud, because that stuff made me, when I was doing that, I wasn't thinking about my pain. And so, but when I was laying in my bed, all I thought about was my pain. That's all I focused on. So my pain became bigger in my head. Like my pain today is the exact same as it was when I couldn't function. It's not changed one bit. If anything, honestly, is like I get older, it's just going to get worse. And I know that, you know, but like I learned how pain brings empathy. It gives you a new lens. Like I remember hearing this quote at that point, that the deeper sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. And I was like, I'm going to get to experience joy on the deepest level because of the level that I know brokenness and pain and sorrow. And I do. Like, I don't, it's not in this, like, Pollyanna-ish thing. It's not like I'm, like, denying all the hard, broken shit that's all around me, because it's very real. And I think it's important to acknowledge and lean into that stuff and, like, never try to, you know, rose color over it. But that stuff has made me, it's given me a lens to like actually see people and to see the world and to like genuinely love people. And like now when I speak, I get to share this message of like, you can live such a full, rich, and beautiful life despite your circumstances. Because the truth is, my circumstances are so hard. Like my pain is really hard. It's shitty, and I wouldn't wish it on a soul. And I miss my dad every day, and I wouldn't wish a divorce on anyone. It's so hard. But those things, those broken things, like, they have only made me a better, like, more whole version of myself. And I believe that for everyone. Like, if there's hope for me, who is a effing nightmare, like, I truly believe there's hope for all of us. And I love getting to share that. And I want to be honest and share, like, what a nightmare I was, to say, like, listen, there's no one's too far gone. None of us are too far gone. Like there's hope for all of us, and you don't have to wait. Like I couldn't, my pain's never going to go away. So I can't just choose to be happy when my pain goes away and when my suffering goes away, because that's not going to go away.
Are you in pain right now?
I am.
Where? Can you tell me where?
But you know what's amazing? I'm not thinking about it, because I'm getting to sit here with you. So I'm not. This is like,
yeah,
such a joy.
I know.
Like I'm not thinking about my pain.
I know. I realize that. I shouldn't ask
no,
where
you're
it
always,
is.
But so my
just tell
whole,
me though, please.
So my whole right side, like from head to toe.
From head to toe. All the way down.
All
right
way
here
down.
Where I'm touching right here?
Mm-hmm.
What does it feel like?
It feels like fire.
Oh, God.
It feels like, so here's another example that might help. I don't know. Like last year when Garrett and I were in Costa Rica, my feet were sandy. We came back from the beach and I didn't want to get in bed with sandy feet. So I turned on the water all the way and I was like just standing there with my right foot under the water. I was like, it didn't feel quite right, but I didn't think about it. It was like 10 seconds. And then I touched it with my left hand and I like literally screamed bloody murder, scared him to death. I like burned the hell out of myself. Like it swelled up and it blistered and it like, but I didn't know because that didn't hurt as much as what the nerve damage feels like.
So you have learned somehow to just manage this.
Yeah.
You just through determination and looking at just all the good stuff, right?
That's the hope.
Is that a very oversimplification?
No, I mean, I never want to come off as like Pollyanna-ish. I guess that's my fear when I talk about this because pain is so hard and I never want to say like, just go look and smile at people and pick a flower and you'll be fine. Like that's bullshit. It's fucking hard. And but I also do truly believe like for me, the things that make my pain feel purposeful is when I can be honest and open about my broken stuff and my struggles, but also piggyback that with like, but yeah. My life is so rich. My life is so full and so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I am been given this gift of having the opportunity. Like I genuinely wouldn't change a thing. It's been so hard and I wouldn't wish it on a soul. It's made me better. Like it's made me better. And it's given me, I feel like it's given me eyes. Like I wasn't able to like enter into other people's pain before because I didn't know pain. I lived this really beautiful, sweet, simple life. And all of a sudden now I can walk with someone who's going through a divorce or heartache. I can walk with someone that's dealing with death. I can walk with someone that's dealing with emotional, physical, spiritual pain because I know it well. And like, that's the stuff that makes my pain feel purposeful. And when I'm sitting here with you and I'm sitting like, you know, when I wake up, I feel awful. But I know if I decide to lay in my bed and focus on how I feel, that's only going to highlight my pain more. And I'm only going to like, it's only going to make it bigger.
Yeah.
When I focus on it. Mentalness is like the mental game is huge. But if I choose to get up and go be with people and go do work that I love and go spend time with humans and enter into their worlds and love them as well as I possibly can, like I'm not thinking about my pain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not.
Is there still hope that, you know, is there therapy out there still? Is there,
you know,
God forbid another surgery, but you know,
to be honest, I don't think so. I don't. Maybe I'm not closed off to trying new things. I think it's so sweet when I'm like, if they've been helped by something they say, and I've tried a million things and I always am like, I so appreciate that. And I'll give something.
Everyone's like, I have, yeah. Oh, I know a doctor.
I appreciate it. That's yeah. So kind. Cause it's coming from yeah. A very dear, sweet place. But I think for me, and I'm not saying this is, I never want to be like, here's the answer for you. This is what's worked for me.
Yeah.
For me, when I lived in that state of like begging to feel better and dying to feel better.
Yeah.
And just all I focused on was like this, I had this anxious panicness of like, I've got to not feel this way. And like, there's something about, I feel so peaceful now. I don't wake up panicked. I've just kind of come to grips with it. Like this is my reality and it's freaking hard. But it is also this thing that's like, I live in a community of people that I can be very open with. Like I have best friends that walk with me that know they can look in my eyes and I don't have to say anything and then be like, go sit down. Let me come rub your back. You know, I am lucky enough to live in a very close-knit community.
Do you get a lot of back rubs?
I get a lot of back rubs. Sweet Amber, Shoni, they just love on me so good. My boy, literally, and I wake up in the night, like, mm-hmm. He's mm-hmm. just instantly starts rubbing my back.
Yeah, there's a new boy.
There is!
Surprise we haven't talked about.
There is. And I tried to push him away with that stuff. I literally did. He's the first person. He's only the second boy I've ever called. What do
you mean? You tried to talk him out of being your boy?
Yeah. I mean, he's only the second boy I've ever called my boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And very early on, I was like, I just had very sobering conversations of like, you know, my pain's really awful now. Mm-hmm. And it had very negative effects on my relationship. Mm-hmm. And it became this third party in our relationship, my old relationship, that we both hated so much. And I'm obviously very different now. And I know that I handle pain very differently now. Mm-hmm. But if there's still a lot of fear, like it, I mean, that was that was very detrimental to my relationship. And I was saying that, and I'm like, and the truth is, as I get older, it's only going to get worse. And I know that. That's fact. And so, and like, he literally shut me down so fast and was just like, I will not let you push me away with that. Like, I am not scared of that. I am not, like, I love all of you. And I know that this is like, has made you who you are, that the human that I love. And that doesn't scare me. So he's amazing. Yeah, I'm very, very lucky. He's a doll. But
I'm ready. You think you're ready now to love again?
I wasn't looking for a boy at all, but he just won me over. And like, it's literally one of those things where it's like, I would be an idiot to let this human pass me by. He is the kindest, most loving, big-hearted. He's shorter than me. That's a first. Never kissed a boy shorter than me before. but he's the cutest thing that ever was. And he's Australian, so he has the best accent in life.
Give me a little Australian.
I can't
accent.
Do it. All I know is when little, I answer, he'll say, he'll, when I answer, he's like, good day. He says, how you going? I'm like, I try to imitate him, and it's a joke, and he tries to imitate me, because I'm about, as you know, as Southern and rednecky as they come. Yeah. And so our accents together are, he adds R's. He'll say Australia. I'm like, there is no R on the end of Australia. But then words that's supposed to be R, he doesn't. Yeah. Like Amber, he calls Amber. And he's just the cutest. I don't know. He loves me very, very, very well.
So he's Australian. Does he live in Australia?
He's from there, but he's actually moving to Nashville for a tall girl.
So he's moving.
Yeah.
From Australia?
No, from New York. He's been from New York. He's been like lead designer at this really rad design firm called Vault 49.
Okay.
And he does like 3D illustration, really cool.
And he's moving to Nashville to be closer to you?
To be with me. He's going to move in with Mr. Theron Humphrey.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. Theron fell in love with him and asked him to be his roommate. It's
you
amazing.
Guys, this whole Nashville community
is
the most ridiculous.
It's true. We're so obsessed with each other. It's not normal, but it's true. It's so good.
Just a bunch of friends.
Just a whole bunch of friends. Mm-hmm. Being friends. We have the best time ever. I'm like, I wish everyone could get a taste of this and have this in their lives, because it's so beautiful.
I feel really lucky just to be hanging out for a week and getting a taste of it.
We love having you here.
It's always so wonderful.
We love it.
All right, let's do rapid fire.
Done.
You want to?
Yeah, boy.
Okay. Who makes the best hip hop?
Oh, well, as of right now, I'd say Queen B, Beyonce, because Lemonade just came out, and I am. It's not hip-hop, but just R&B. Kanye's the worst human in life, but I love his new record.
This is so funny. I actually have a question on here. It's like later on. I have Kanye or Beyonce.
Oh, Beyonce all the way. Yeah. Hands down. No doubt.
I figured that's what it was going to be.
No question.
Yeah.
I mean, my all-time old-school favorite is Tupac.
Yeah?
Tupac.
Which Tupac? Give
me
Take me back.
Dear Mama is my favorite song.
Dear Mama.
Oh, I had in college, I had this white, feminine, very simple, clean-lined room with a life-size poster of Tupac that said, only God can judge me, and I loved it. Like, what y'all don't know right now is I look like I would only listen to, like, singer-songwriter country music. Like, I look like the biggest redneck, but I can sing along to every hip-hop song that ever was in life, and I love it. Dirtier, the better.
I can confirm.
It's true.
You
it's
know
real.
Every.
It's true.
You know them all.
And I love dancing.
You know them all. What percentage of the day are you wearing a hat?
I'd say 80% of the day.
80%.
Yeah, I take it off to go to bed.
Okay. Yeah.
great question, Tyson.
Do you have a favorite toy as a child?
No, I didn't. I was so interested in so many things. Mm-hmm. I'll get excited by so many things. The only consistent, this is going to sound psycho because it's still the same. The only consistent thing, like my comfort was a pillow and I still have it. Like if you're in my home, I'll be holding a brown pillow and it's like.
You've had the same pillow since childhood?
I've had, no, one got lost in the hospital, which we won't talk about it because it was a real sad day. There's been like a variation, like every decade, one just gets really, really, really repulsive and disgusting and I have to move on and I get the same kind and the same type of pillowcase. Mm-hmm. It's a very specific type of feather down pillow and there's this brown pillowcase. It's the grossest looking thing you've ever seen, but I literally like, I fly with it. When I was going to Costa Rica with Garrett, I was like, I knew that I couldn't bring a big pillow because we just had backpacks. And so I just bought the pillowcase and I would put it on the pillows everywhere we go so I could just hold it. It's like that's my comfort. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Oh, it's real.
What is a word you say more than you probably should?
Like a bad word?
Sure, anywhere.
I mean, the word that might be annoying is just grateful because I probably do say it, but I mean it. Or favorite. Like sometimes I'm like, I wonder if people think it's disingenuous because in the moment I'll be like, oh, this is one of my favorite things. And I know that if you didn't know me, you'd be like, bitch, you said that four other times today. Like you are full of shit. But in the moment, I'm like, right now, this feels like my favorite thing I've experienced. And it's real. Like, I promise. It's so real. But I also understand that, like, maybe you wouldn't even trust my words if I say that so much. You know what I mean? So that's probably a word I say. The other word's probably the fuck word. But that's the bad word.
I love that you said the fuck word.
Yeah.
Instead of the F word. Yeah.
Too much. But probably favorite.
Describe the contents of the perfect drink.
Oh, done. Okay. There's a drink here called a penicillin, and it is my most favorite drink in life. I know you've had it in Atlanta. They make them so good. So it's basically a very peaty scotch, and the honey ginger syrup is what I've learned is like the clutch part. It has to be done well. I don't know how to do it well. I don't know where to buy it where it's perfect. And
where do you get it?
Rolf and Daughters, hands down. Best penicillin I've ever put in my mouth. Like I daydream about it. I want it in my mouth at all times. So it's a peaty scotch, a amazing honey ginger syrup, and then they float it with Lafroy. So it has this like smoky peaty, but still has this like honey sweetness of like the honey ginger syrup. It's just it hits every sense of mine perfectly. I love it. So,
sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's important.
If it wasn't 10:59 a.m., we might go get a couple.
We'll go this afternoon. It's fun.
What superpower would you like to have?
Oh, healing. They wouldn't necessarily, not for me necessarily, but.
Oh, come on.
Healing.
You would want it. Yeah. Healing would be an awesome superpower. Like, how about like the kind where like something happens to you and it just grows back or whatever?
I feel like, honestly, I would be more for hearts. Like, I know physical pain is the worst, but I don't know that there's much more than like heart and mental pain. Like, there are people in my life that I love deeply who have such mental anguish every day. They have perfect mental shape, physical shape, but their minds are just tormented and it breaks my heart. So.
So you want to be a Care Bear, is what you're saying?
Yeah, Care Bear. That'd be great. Yeah.
Sir Hearts a Lot or whatever. Yes. Isn't that was his special power, right? It was like,
oh my God, we're dating ourselves.
He would
so
heal
hard.
Your heart. Like that was his thing. With a Care Bear stare.
We're like, everyone else will not know that reference.
I watched the Care Bears movie.
Oh, yeah.
And fucking cried my eyes out when they did the Care Bear stare at the end to warm Nicodemus's heart or whatever that kid's name was. It was like that really awful kid.
Oh.
And he was mean and he had some, you know, I can't really remember the story. But I remember
like
at the end, they all line up.
Well.
They all line up and they give him the Care Bears there and they like shoot like a
goodness
rainbow right into his
heart.
Yeah, right into his face.
I want to be a Care Bear when I grow up.
Yeah, you are literally a Care Bear. Yeah. What is the, what's the biggest risk you've ever taken?
I would say when I first had to start working, that was really learning to say yes to job opportunities and learning. For the longest time, I didn't do anything that I knew would make my pain worse. So I didn't travel. I didn't dance. If it's going to make me feel worse, I'm not going to do it. And so I didn't do anything. And so that first year, like learning to say yes to things and learning to say yes to go on these trips and learning to say yes to like doing jobs that I knew were going to have a pretty big impact on my body. But, you know, doing those things were so life-giving and mentally pleasing and just brought so much joy and life that it only was just like a snowball effect where I just wanted to do it more, and that's more and more what I was capable of. Mm-hmm. and how I let fear hold me back for the longest time. And I would say now, like, I'm proud of myself for letting myself love again and be loved. You know, it's a risk. It's scary, but also
it's always a risk.
It's always a risk, but it's worth it. You know,
what's the best meal you've ever had?
Oh, God. Got it. So,
No hesitation.
No, zero hesitations. Mm-hmm. A few weeks ago, Jed and I got to take over Airbnb Snapchat for the day, and our last stop was Husk. And my friend, his girl is one of my dearest friends here, Audie, and his name is Sean Brock, and he is like a James Beard award-winning master chef. And he created a 10-course meal for us. It was like nothing I have ever, I cried. Like a little bitch, I cried. Because it was literally like, you knew that you're experiencing something so set apart. He's like this master of, he's like a scientist, mad scientist, but like creative artist, chef something. I've never experienced anything like it. And I thought I was gonna like roll out. I've never been so full, but it was like I felt like it would have been sinful for me not to put these things in my mouth because it was the best things that I've ever put in my mouth.
What are these things?
I don't even know where to start. He started us with this like gumbo roux that we drank, and then he brought us like this meat that had been curing for over a year. It'd been like soaking in salt. I don't even know the words. I am the most ignorant human. I feel embarrassed even trying to articulate what it was that I put in my mouth. But all I know, it was the best thing. The shrimp and grits were like nothing I'd ever experienced.
Yeah.
And then he finished it. Just to even top it off, he opened a bottle of 65-year-old whiskey and gave us like, it was like the best bourbon.
So this is all good old fashioned Southern cooking.
Oh, he is a Southern. His fried chicken will make go to Husk.
That's where I should go.
Husk. It's all you need to know. Okay. It's so important. I can even tell you.
Name the one place you are desperate to visit.
Oh God, that's so hard because there's so many. Up to a year ago, or even a few months ago, I'd say Australia, and I'm going with my fella in 3 weeks, so I'm just batshit excited. I read Power of One, which takes place in South Africa, when I was 18, and read it again out of bed, and I've always wanted to go. There's so many places. Literally, this game could go on.
South Africa sounds like a great place.
South Africa. Mm-hmm. I'm dying to go to Morocco.
Is there a particular part of South Africa?
All over. Because the book takes place in like so many different spots. And so I would literally like highlight and be like, I've got to experience this. Wow. Like, I know it'll be really intense also. But I just like, after I read that book, I started reading all these books. I get like really hyper-focused. And when I get excited about something, and then I get excited about something else. But South Africa, we'll stop there. But there's like 30 billion other places.
So I think I already know the answer to this one because I think we've already covered it. But how many times have you been in love?
Two.
When was the last time you barfed?
Tyson Wheatley. You know this answer, you should.
Did you barf last night?
No! When you carried me upstairs. Okay, y'all, I'm going to give a backstory.
Okay.
I have only vomited from alcohol one time in my life. In my life, I've only vomited once. And it was the night I met Tyson. Is that why you brought this up? You forgot?
No, I remember, but I didn't realize that it was the one and only time.
That's the only time.
I feel so honored now.
Y'all, this is what I remember. So it was the first time I've ever been to Urban Cowboy in Brooklyn. They're like, who is this tall girl who cannot handle her liquor? But they, for some reason, loved me. I was so lucky. But anyway, we had a party. I drank a lot of Bullet. It happened. And a lot of Bullet. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting down. And I had not been drinking very long at that point. And I turn green. And I lock myself in the bathroom and literally start exploding vomit. It was like projectile. It was so bad. And finally, sweet Jessica, J Mombi, mm-hmm. She has to get all grown up on me and is like, Ruthie, unlock the door. Unlock the door. I would not unlock the door. I was so
She was very concerned.
She was very concerned.
Yeah.
So sweet Tyson, I had never met him before, carries me upstairs, and this is all I remember saying. You don't even know me yet.
You were so worried.
I was so worried
about this being the first impression.
Because I'd never even done this before. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I look like this horrific human, I'm sure. Thanks, Tyson, for bringing up my one vomit night. Appreciate it, Buddy Row. You're the best. Okay.
Okay, these next ones are real easy. Perfect Saturday night album.
Oh, gracious. Well, lately, I've been listening to The Lone Bellow a lot. They rented out my house to record on their new record, and I had not heard their music before. And it's amazing. His voice is spectacular, and it's just great, chill background, beautiful music.
What's it called? Lone Bellow?
The Lone Bellow.
Bellow.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds so cool. Good. Okay. And what about Perfect Sunday Morning album?
I mean, when I wake up, I put on rap music. So right now, Lemonade is on constant rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Genuinely, I wake up. That's like what helps me get up and like want to move and dance a little bit. And so it's like part of it is a mental thing too, just because
I just feel like this is the second time we talked Lemonade. So like, can we just break it down for me?
Yes.
Like, is what is going on? Is this like real?
It's real.
Like Jay-Z cheated on her.
Yes. And this is her process of like healing. And she goes through every emotion that you would feel with like the grief, the anger, the.
It's powerful.
It's so powerful. Sorry is like her like F you song that I literally listen to.
That's the one where she's like.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. You keep messing around, you're going to lose your wife, right? Throws the
ring. That's the fourth song with Jack White. That was that's my third favorite.
Yeah.
All Night is my second favorite. And that's the redemption, song at the end that makes me want to cry every time I hear it.
Mm-hmm.
It's important. I'm telling you, I watched the full film.
I keep wondering, like, are we being duped here? Not duped, but are we being, is this all so calculated?
I mean, I think they're both. It's like her real experience, but they're also brilliant marketers. So it's both.
Yeah. I hope it all works out.
Me too.
Okay. Last question.
Yes.
Favorite Instagram?
Oh, man.
I know. It's impossible.
Come on. I would have to say Jed. It's a lot of words, but my best friend Jedediah Jenkins, like, he oftentimes he puts words to things that I don't even realize I think it or know it until he says it. He's just the most articulate. He doesn't take great photos. It has nothing to do with photos, which is what Instagram is, but it's all about heart, emotion, and hilarity. Like, he's the funniest human I've ever met. Makes me laugh harder than anyone I know, but also like we will have these heart to hearts where it's like we will talk philosophy, meaning of life, like humans, the heart, the relationship. And he has this pulse on humanity like probably no one I know. It's spectacular, but that it has nothing to do with photos or like what Instagram, it's literally just, it's his heart and his words. Such an honor and such a gift, and I can't believe that I somehow weaseled my way into being in all y'all's lives.
Oh, shut up. How do you say goodbye in Nashville? How's the Nashville style goodbye?
Oh, well, right now, because of Lemonade, all I say is boy bye. That's what I say over and over is boy bye. But gosh, I mean, everything has to do with y'all.
No, that's good. We can say boy bye.
Boy bye.
Boy bye. Mm-hmm. And is there a snap or was that just?
No, she goes boy bye.
Okay.
Yep, that's it.
That's it.
All right, guys, that's it for episode 3. Thank you so much for listening to Tinker Podcast. Thanks again to Ruthie Lindsay for sharing her incredible story. Tinker Podcast, the artwork has been done by Kyle Steed. He's an incredible illustrator. I want to thank him so much. Go to kylesteed.com to see his incredible work. And the music we are so lucky to have has been performed by Ben Schuyler and Jordan Campbell, a.k.a. A Weekend at the Feelies. Go check out their work at aweekendatthefeelies.bandcamp.com. We'll be back again next week. We're going to have a couple special episodes to share with you coming up. I'm really excited about, I'm really grateful for this this chance to do this podcast. It's really something that's been fun to do, and making a lot of efforts to make them interesting and better to listen to. I know the audio is needs a little work, so we're working behind the scenes to make it a more enjoyable experience. Again, if you want to drop me some feedback, I always love to hear from people. Tyson Wheatley at gmail.com, and I hope to hear from you soon. Thanks for listening. Take care.